Tracy.
I'm April.
And this is Killer Spirits.
Welcome to episode 45.
Episode 45.
We're here. I feel like I'm still worn out from last week's episode.
I'm worn.
I'm still highly worn.
I'm worn out from writing this episode.
Are you?
Yeah.
It's April today. It's all April today.
It's a brutal one.
I'm so excited. But I made a killer drink.
It's true.
For killer spirits.
That's right.
I made a killer spirit today. It was so good. And I am actually excited about it because we're getting close to fall. I'm getting excited for fall. I know there's probably people out there who are like, oh my God, it's too early. But you know what? I don't think it's too early. I'm okay with it. I'm ushering in the Halloween.
And you know what? What's wrong with people enjoying stuff?
Exactly. Find your own business. Come on, guys. Like, who cares if things are out early? Maybe we're enjoying it. Give me a little joy in this world. Oh my God. So I'm excited for pumpkin time. And today we have a pumpkin inspired drink.
Delicious.
For multiple reasons, which I guess you'll find out during the episode. I don't know much about this story, but I did make the drink today, which I'm excited to tell you about. So if you want to usher in pumpkin time as well, this is a good drink, but it's also very refreshing. So it's not a heavy pumpkin drink at all.
No.
It's very refreshing. So this is what you're going to do. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Write it down, people. So first you're going to take some glasses, and I think I used just like, what are those called? The highball glasses.
Mm-hmm.
I used those, and I rimmed.
Well, actually, the ones you used are technically like old-fashioned glasses.
Oh, because I used the shorter ones.
Yes, you could use highballs, though.
What? Just use whatever you want.
Usually with a sparkling topper, you use a highball. It's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. I didn't do it this time. First, you're going to rim the glass with honey, and then you're going to dip it in brown sugar. So you're going to have a brown sugar honey rim. So delicious. So for two drinks, you're going to use 2 ounces of pumpkin puree. Though I actually thought you could add even a little bit extra.
I think you could have done more.
I think I could have done more. 2 teaspoons of honey, a half of a whole lemon, just the juice, 3 ounces of bourbon, and then you're going to top it with ginger beer. So this is how you do it. First, you're going to put a little bit of your honey, your lemon juice, and your pumpkin puree in a shaker, but I didn't put ice in it yet. I went ahead and just like mixed it around a little bit to get it all orientated. And then I put the ice and the bourbon in and shook it up really, really good. Put it in the glass, topped it with the ginger beer. Mm-hmm. And I think pouring it over ice is actually nice too.
Yeah, I think pouring it over ice is kind of essential.
Yeah, it really is. And then I just did a little sprig of lemon peel right on the top.
It was really very good.
It was so refreshing. And the amount of ginger beer is all up to you. Mm. But it does give it a nice freshness. It's almost like the other stuff you make is a little bit thick and it's a little bit of a base for it. Mm-hmm. And then you put the ginger beer in it. Oh.
Yeah, I think that like I was surprised. I mean, obviously bourbon and pumpkin goes together. But I was surprised at how well it went together.
It is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's so good.
With the brown
so
sugar.
Good. Yeah, so I feel like now I'm going to be on like a pumpkin cocktail rampage.
I mean, get ready for a pumpkin cocktail next week and the week after and the week after. We need to do like Halloween murders or something.
Yeah, actually, apple ones are always fun for fall too. I feel like we did one last fall for apple.
So actually, we're coming up on our 1 year anniversary.
What?
October 24th.
That's so exciting.
So it's like maybe it's October 25th. We still have a couple months, but this like Halloween time,
yes,
is our anniversary time.
Yeah. And also I think when I get the most excited for life, you know, basically it's just Halloween, fall stuff, and then Christmas stuff is fun.
Oh my God, I love Christmas so much.
We love it. And that's when we can take pictures of our cocktails in front of the Christmas tree.
Yes, I start to get like ramped up.
Get ready, guys.
Well, because my birthday is next week.
Yes. And so then it's like, my birthday.
Yes. So it's like once my birthday hits, I'm like, oh, this is the good time of year.
I know. And then when my birthday hits, we're deep in it.
We're in it.
We're deep in it.
OK, Okay, well, I will tell you, this one is really bad.
I'm so glad it's you this week. I'm so excited.
I said this is the one I was going to do, and then I didn't want to change it because I'd already gotten so far into the book that it would just have been a waste of time. But then also I didn't really want to do it.
So you
but
just here I am doing it.
Slogging through it. So this one reminds me of The Vampire Sacramento.
Really?
Yes.
That was a bad one. I agree.
It's not as, I mean, I don't know. It's just reminiscent.
Okay.
So firstly, I'm going to go into the signs and symptoms of borderline personality personality disorder.
Do it. Borderline.
Borderline.
BPD. Personality disorder.
So the signs and symptoms may include an intense fear of abandonment, even going to extreme measures to avoid real or imagined separation or rejection. Ooh. Emphasis on the imagined. Doesn't always have to be real. A pattern of unstable, intense relationships, such as idealizing someone one moment and then suddenly believing the person doesn't care enough or is cruel. Ooh. Periods of stress-related paranoia and loss of contact with reality, lasting from a few minutes to a few hours. Impulsive and risky behavior, such as gambling, reckless driving, unsafe sex, spending sprees, binge eating, or drug abuse, or sabotaging success by suddenly quitting a good job or ending a positive relationship.
Wow.
Suicidal threats or behavior or self-injury, often in response to fear of separation or rejection. Wide mood swings lasting from a very few hours to a few days, which can include intense happiness, irritability, shame, or anxiety. So highs and lows. And lastly, inappropriate, intense anger, such as frequently losing your temper, being sarcastic or bitter, or having physical fights.
Wow.
So today we're talking about Catherine Knight. And it is undeniable that Catherine Knight had many of the signs and symptoms of BPD. You will notice a theme of these symptoms coming up again and again in Catherine's story. So throughout the story, I'm going to call her Kathy.
Okay.
Because that's what they called her. Although if you are looking her up or you want to find more information, Catherine. And I also wanted to shout out the book that I read for this one. I guess I should know the name of the book, huh? I know the name. It's called Beyond Bad, The Life and Crimes of Catherine Knight, Australian's Hannibal.
Whoa.
Australia's Hannibal. It's by written by Sandra Lee and read by Kate Hood. I got the Audible version, and the Audible version is in an Australian accent. So,
well, then that's...
I liked that.
Yeah, I would like that too.
And the story in the book, it's like, I don't know, maybe 300 pages. She really goes into a lot of interviews with people who knew Kathy, neighbors of hers, friends, people from when she was in school, ex-boyfriends, people that were in relationships with her. It's like a broad swath of interviews of people, and like sort of firsthand accounts with dealing with this person. Very interesting. I would highly recommend it.
It sounds very interesting. I feel like I might have heard some of this story before, but I don't know the full story. So that excites me.
Yeah, it's an odd one.
Your face. Well, let's just dive right in the oddity of it all.
Okay, so this story starts with Kathy's parents. Her mother, Barbara Ruffin, was married to Jack Ruffin. They lived in the small town of Aberdeen in New South Wales, Hunter Valley, Australia, and had four sons together. Barbara had an affair with Ken Knight, who was a coworker and friend of her husband, Jack.
Oh, dear.
The affair was a big scandal in the conservative small town, as both families were well known. So Barbara moved out with Ken, and two of the boys that they had stayed with Jack, and the other two went to live with their aunt Nan in Sydney, which is such a cute name for Aunt
Nan.
Aunt.
I want to be an Aunt Nan.
Aunt Nan. And from what I heard in the book, Aunt Nan gave them a really good life.
Oh, okay.
They were really well taken care of in Sydney. And actually those two kids don't really ever end up crossing paths with their mom again. Oh. I mean, they do when they're like later in their teenage lives. But as their kids, they stay with Nan and Sydney.
So she doesn't raise them, really.
Right. Barbara and Jack moved to Gunnedah, South New Wales, in 1955. So I would say they got maybe run out of town a little bit.
Wow, 1955. This is longer ago. It's further back in time than I thought this story was for some reason.
Well, this is when she's born.
Oh, that's true. Okay, yeah. So this is her parents. Yeah. That's right.
So they got kind of pushed out of town because it's a conservative small town. It was a big scandal. Mm-hmm. They skipped town. On October 24th, 1955, Catherine and her twin sister Joy. She's a twin. And it's kind of funny. I didn't really put it in my story, but the book talks about her twin quite a bit. And as they got older, they lived close to each other, and they always got along really well. And Catherine was, like, very much a strong-headed, intense person. And Joy was kind of, like, not really that. It's interesting to see the story between the two twins.
They were just very opposite in personality.
Very opposite, yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, so in 1959, Jack Ruffin, who's her ex-husband, passed away. And so the two boys that were living with him then moved in with Barbara and Ken. And then Barbara and Ken had one more boy in 1961.
Okay.
So according to the book, Ken worked hard, long hours on rotating shifts as a meat cutter at a slaughterhouse. Barbara didn't work, and Ken was making enough to support all five kids they had living with them.
Wow.
Barbara was a spitfire and a hothead. She was a strong-handed disciplinarian with her children, and she cussed like a sailor.
Okay.
Yeah, she was a mean bitch. So, not as bad as Kathy, but according to another source that I found on Murderpedia, don't know how accurate that is, Ken was an alcoholic who used violence and intimidation to rape Barbara up to 10 times a day.
The hell?
So first of all, I don't know how you would have time to do that if you're working rotating shifts.
How can you even get it up 10 times a day?
You got to be so tired.
You can't do
it. So I think this sort of stuff that comes up on like the Wikipedia stuff is from Kathy as she's being interviewed later in life.
Like when it comes directly from the source.
And I think she has some like, there's some things.
Okay. But there could have been violence there.
There could have been, for
sure. But I still don't know if I believe up to 10 times a day.
And also, Barbara was often inappropriately open with her girls about hating sex and men and providing intimate details of their sex life.
Okay, gross.
So, I mean, maybe Kathy was scarred by that. Maybe her mom yes. just said something like that, and she's like, oh, yeah, that's the truth.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. I don't know. Kathy also claims that she was sexually abused by several members of her family, not her father, which continued until she was 11. Psychologists questioned this, but it was apparently corroborated by other members of the family. Okay. So
could contribute to the personality disorder.
Right. We're not sure who abused her, just that she was abused. Kathy also had a really hard time at school. In the book, she was described as a handsome woman, but not pretty.
Okay.
She had wild red hair and glasses, and she very much had her own sense of style. It didn't much align with the times.
Oh, okay. I feel like I've been that way. She was unconventional.
Yeah. The boys at school gave her the hardest time, especially when her and Joy rode the bus home. But Kathy also wasn't afraid to give those boys a beat down once they got off the bus.
Okay.
Joy said she always knew her sister was about to go off when she said, "Joy, hold my glasses."
Oh, shit.
Yeah, she's about to go after those boys. Kathy didn't make it in school very long. I think she stayed in high school for maybe a year. Mm. And when she dropped out, she was basically illiterate.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Kathy had a slew of tumultuous relationships, and she was very violent at times. Kathy was often the aggressor, and she would go into an absolute rage if she felt slighted or if she got jealous. The weird thing, though, about Kathy's personality is that she was also thoughtful and giving.
Mm.
So, of course, they do interviews with a bunch of neighbors, friends, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
People said she was always willing to lend a hand to her neighbor. If she saw someone was out working on the yard, she might show up with a chainsaw and help cut branches and clear brush. But she was a person who couldn't stand being offended in any way. And she blew, you know, something that would be a minor affront into brutal, violent assaults.
And that probably happened a lot in her relationships with men.
We'll hear about it. In other words, she was a hard bitch.
Okay.
Like,
she was obviously a strong personality times 1,000.
Yes. And violent.
Yeah.
And this particular person found her perfect job that coincided with her love of violence. She followed in her dad's footsteps and started working in the abattoir or slaughterhouse.
So she's going to get some knife skills. Super duper knife skills.
She's going to spend about 14 years in the abattoir as a slicer. So in the book, it talks about how interested Kathy was with all aspects of the abattoir. But she would frequently go to the killing area. She had made friends with a man who worked down there and would often hang around and watch the killing of the animals take place. Nobody really thought anything of it because she already worked there. So they were kind of like, oh, she's just learning other aspects of the job.
Yeah. I mean, if you already worked there, it's not like you just showed up on the street or something. So right. Yeah, that wouldn't be weird.
She just happened to make a friend down there and spent time down there.
Right. But she... It sounds like she enjoyed watching the animals be slaughtered.
Yes. So there's a word for someone who enjoys death. I think it's a necrophile.
Yeah.
They called her, in the book, they called her a necrophile.
And then if you really like having sex with dead people, you're a necrophilia.
She didn't do that. But as far as I know, she didn't do that. But she sort of surrounds herself with death, which we'll get to later. She enjoys witnessing and being with death.
Being around it.
Right. Which is a necrophile. So studies show that working in an abattoir often leads to a high amount of psychological trauma. This is present day. I mean, anytime they're doing these studies.
Okay.
It puts workers at risk of negative coping behavior, perpetration-induced traumatic stress, which is a form of PTSD, PITS results from situations where the concerning subject suffered from PTSD, was a casual participant in creating the traumatic situation. So as a worker in an abattoir, you are told to murder an animal,
right,
and be surrounded by killing. It's not your own ideation to do it.
Right. Yeah, so it's your job.
It's sort of like PTSD. It's a form of PTSD.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So in 2009, a study by criminologist Amy Fitzgerald indicates slaughterhouse employment increased total arrests for violent crimes, arrests for rape, and arrests for other sex offenses in comparison with other industries.
That makes so much sense to me because it's not normal behavior for humans to want to kill anything,
right,
or to be around death like that all the time.
As authors from the PTSD Journal explain, these employees are hired to kill animals such as pigs and cows that are largely gentle creatures. Carrying out this action requires workers to disconnect from what they are doing and from the creature standing before them. This emotional dissonance can lead to consequences such as domestic violence, social withdrawal, anxiety, drug and alcohol abuse, and PTSD. In the words of a meat processing employee, quote, the worst thing, worse than the physical danger, because it's also very physically dangerous,
yeah,
is the emotional toll. If you work in the stick pit where hogs are killed for any period of time, that lets you kill things, but it doesn't let you care. You may look a hog in the eye that's walking around the blood pit and you think, God, that really is a bad looking animal. You may want to get it. Oh, sorry. You may want to pet it. Pigs down on the kill floor have come up to nuzzle me like a puppy. 2 minutes later, I had to kill them, beat them to death with a pipe. I can't care. That's bad.
That's really bad. And I mean, I was actually in FFA mm-hmm. when I was in high school, and they slaughtered pigs and we were all there.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it is, I still very, very strongly remember doing it.
Yeah.
The memory is very strong. And I can't imagine having that be your daily job.
Every day.
For people years. Do it. And, you know, it's obviously.
And I'm glad that people do it, because then we wouldn't be able to eat.
Well, we would. You'd be vegan.
Yeah.
You could. We definitely all could. We'll survive and be fine. But, yeah, I mean, that's a rough job to have. Very yeah. rough.
So I'm going to start getting into Kathy's relationships.
Okay. I want to hear.
So, blah, blah, blah. She worked in the abattoir for 14 years. She's,
blah, blah, blah.
She's a weirdo. She loves death. Okay.
Okay.
So serious relationship number one, Kathy met her first, you know, not just dating boyfriend, like boyfriend.
Serious.
Yes. He was a hard-drinking coworker.
Oh, great.
named David Stanford Kellett. They met in 1973. And she completely dominated him. Kellett got into a fight at the hotel, Knight would step in and back him up with her fist without fail.
Dang, she was scrappy.
She was bad. In Aberdeen, she was renowned for offering armed combat to anyone who upset her.
Jeez.
To anyone who upset her. Knight married Kellett in 1974 at her request, with a couple arriving at the service on her motorcycle with a very intoxicated Kellett riding on the back, which I think is such a funny, like.
Like, did he even know what he was doing?
Who knows? As soon as they arrived, Knight's mother, Barbara, gave Kellett some advice. In quotes from Kellett, "The old girl said to me to watch out. You better watch this one or she'll fucking kill you. Stir her up the wrong way or do the wrong thing and you're fucked. Don't ever think of playing up on her. She'll fucking kill you." And that was her mother talking. She told me she's got something loose. She's got a screw loose somewhere.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So, I mean,
happy wedding day.
Right. Totally apropos of Barbara to say that, though, because she was such like a spitfire.
Right.
Like, she just really gave it
she
to you.
She wasn't
how it
mincing
was.
Words at all.
So maybe it's kind of like, okay, Barbara. You know, like, she's a little dramatic.
Like, calm down, Barb.
Yeah, we know, you know, being wow. dramatic, but not so much. Because on their wedding night, she tried to strangle him.
What? On the wedding night?
Yes. Knight explained it was because he fell asleep after only having sex 3 times.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm tired just listening to that.
Yeah. The marriage was particularly violent, and on one occasion, a heavily pregnant Knight burned all Kellett's clothing and shoes before hitting him across the back of the head with a frying pan.
What?
Because he had arrived home late from a darts competition after making the finals. In fear for his life, Kellett fled before collapsing in a neighbor's house, and he was later treated for a badly fractured skull. Police wanted to charge her, but Knight was now on her best behavior and talked Kellett into dropping the charges.
And also, I feel like it's really difficult for people to recognize when women are the aggressors.
Yes.
Doing, like, basically perpetrating the domestic violence.
Right. And she also has a habit of, I think because of her BPD or whatever in her mind, she has a habit of being very intense and aggressive, doing something violent and horrible, and then in a couple days she's begging for them to come back. "I'm so sorry. You know, I didn't mean that."
Which is normal, you know.
Abusive behavior.
Exactly.
Yeah. So in May 1976, shortly after the birth of their first child, Melissa Ann, Kellett left her for another woman and moved to Queensland.
Oh, dear.
Apparently unable to cope with Knight's possessive, violent behavior. The next day, Knight was seen pushing her new baby in a pram, which I think is like a buggy.
Yeah.
Down the main street, violently throwing the pram from side to side.
Wait, what? With the baby in it?
With the baby in it. Knight was admitted to St. Elmo's Hospital in Tamworth, where she was diagnosed with postnatal depression, which would now be postpartum depression, and spent several weeks recovering. After being released, Knight placed 2-month-old Melissa on a railway line shortly before the train was due. then stole an axe, went into town, and threatened to kill several people.
Oh my God, my eyeballs are like fucking saucers right now. She put crazy? Her baby on a fucking rail line and then left the baby there?
Yes. A man, and then went into town and threatened to kill several people with an axe.
Okay. Okay, what happens to the baby? I need to know.
Cuckoo bananas.
The cuckoo bananas yeah. is not even the term.
A man known in the district as Old Ted, I'm guessing he was like kind of a hobo or transient, who was foraging near the railway. Near the railway line, found and rescued Melissa.
Oh my God, Old Ted, thank you so much.
By all accounts, only minutes before the train passed.
Oh my God.
Knight was arrested and again taken to St. Elmo's Hospital, but apparently recovered. Signed herself out
the
next day.
Did not get that baby back. No.
Yeah, she got the baby back.
Fuck, what the fuck?
Yeah. Well, and this is in the 70s, so I don't know.
Okay, yeah, the 70s were basically the Wild West. I don't know what to say. They were the Wild West everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, all over the world. Like, what the fuck, 70s?
Yeah, so a few days later, Knight slashed the face of a woman with one of her knives.
What?
And demanded she drive her to Queensland to find Kellett. She wanted to find her, the man who got away.
And I'm sorry, Kellett, I'm glad that you got away, but why did you just leave your baby? Like, is he not even fighting for her? Wow.
I think he was too afraid for his life.
Okay, but it's literally your child.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, we don't know.
Yeah.
But it's crazy to
the
me.
Woman escaped after they stopped at a service station, but by the time police arrived, Knight had taken a little boy hostage and was threatening him with a knife. She was disarmed when police attacked her with brooms. Why brooms?
Were they like sweeping?
I don't know. And she was admitted to the Morissette Psychiatric Hospital. Knight told the nurses she had intended to kill the mechanic at the service station because he had repaired Kellett's car.
Oh, so it's his fault.
Which had allowed him to leave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then kill both her husband and his mother when she arrived in Queensland.
Oh, that makes perfect sense, April.
When police informed Kellett of the incident, he left his girlfriend along with his mother, and they both moved to Aberdeen to support her.
So he basically went back to support crazy Catherine.
Yeah, or his baby, I guess.
Which, okay, I mean, yeah, I totally get coming back for your child and saving her.
So on August 9th, 1976, Kathy was released into the care of her mother-in-law along with Kellett. Because they're like, holy fuck, you're having a complete mental breakdown. And you have a baby. I'll come back and try to take care of you with my mom.
Okay.
And then they moved to Woodridge, a suburb of Brisbane, where she obtained a job at Dinmore Meatworks in nearby Ipswich.
So she's cutting up more animals.
She's cutting meat.
Great.
On March 6, 1980, they had another daughter. Stupid.
Why, yeah, though?
Her name is Natasha Marie.
I mean, I'm glad they were born, but...
Come on. And actually, I don't talk about it, like, in my writing, but in the book, her kids were interviewed. And her kids said, like, yeah, she was pretty strict, but she was always a good mom.
So they loved her. And they grew up to be okay.
They grew up to be okay.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay.
As far as I know, I don't think they gave out a whole lot of information about their lives. Cause
well, that's good.
Pretty like, it was really big in the news. But I think... Her daughter was interviewed to say, like, she was pretty brutal in the beginning. She was a really strict, like, hard-handed mom. And then she kind of realized, like, these aren't the times anymore. And I don't need to discipline my kids like my mom disciplined me.
Okay.
And she kind of let up on them a little bit.
Oh, well, that's good.
So, sort of weird that she's picking and choosing who she's extremely violent with. I don't know.
Well, I'm glad she wasn't. I mean, besides putting her kid, like, on a fucking railway, I'm glad that that might have been the only bad thing that happened. Yeah. And Old Ted deserves a fucking award.
Well, and I think that her husband probably thought that it was just postpartum depression or something.
I mean, she was already a little...
Wackadoodle.
Before, yeah.
Well, but he was kind of a little wackadoodle, too, so...
Yeah. Or just drunk.
Or just drunk, yeah. So, anyway, on March 6, 1980, they had another daughter, Natasha Marie. In 1984, Knight left Kellett and moved in first with her parents in Aberdeen, then to a rented house in nearby Muswellbrook. Although she returned to work at the abattoir, she injured her back the following year and went on a disability pension. I guess there's a lot of, like, bending, lifting, stuff like that. Yeah. So it's pretty easy to get injured working in an abattoir.
Right.
No longer needing to rent accommodation close to her work, the government gave her a housing commission house in Aberdeen. So she's set.
Okay.
So I'm going to move on to the second serious relationship, David Sanders. Maybe Saunders.
Is this two Davids in a row? I feel like it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
David Kellett.
Davids, run for your lives.
David Saunders. So Kathy met 38-year-old minor David Saunders in 1986.
Wait.
Like in the mines.
She's a grown-ass woman and he's 13?
No. He's 38.
Oh, I thought you said he was 13.
He works in... That'd be crazy.
Okay, that makes sense.
He works in the mines. He's minor, not a minor.
Oh, minor. Okay, I was thinking a minor as in he's 13. No,
it's like a flashlight on his forehead.
Okay. Minor. Like he's spelunking into caves and stuff. Exactly. He's not a 13-year-old minor.
Exactly. Okay. A 38-year-old minor, David Saunders, in 1986. A few months later, he moved in with her and her two daughters, although he kept his old apartment in Scone, which I think is such a funny name for a place.
I love that name. I want to live there.
So he held on to his old apartment, which was smart.
Mm-hmm.
Cause she cray cray.
Yes. Maybe he knew deep down.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think he had to look very deep. Kathy soon became jealous regarding what he did when she was not around.
In the mines.
And she would often throw him out.
Jeez.
She would move back into his apartment. Oh, sorry. He would move back into his apartment in Scone, and then she would invariably follow up and beg him to return.
And he would.
Of course. In May 1987, she casually cut the throat of his two-month-old dingo puppy.
No.
In front of him for no more reason than as an example of what would happen if he ever had an affair.
And again.
Before going on to knock him unconscious with a frying pan.
Oh, she likes the frying pan. And she's used to cutting animals, so to her that wasn't even a stretch.
Nope.
Okay, so what did he do?
Not much.
Oh, he woke up and was like, hey, babe.
No, because in June of 1988, she gave birth to her third daughter, Sarah.
That's what I mean. So he woke up from his frying pan incident and basically was like, hey, babe.
Yeah. Which prompted Saunders to put a deposit on a house, which Kathy paid off with her workers' compensation, which came through in 1989. So she must have got a big settlement. Mm. Kathy decorated the house just the way she liked it, which is part of the necrophilia thing. The walls were covered in cow hides, water buffalo, and steer horns, old-fashioned fur wraps, cow and sheep skulls, and deer antlers. Prominently displayed was a stuffed peacock and a baby deer. Among the other bric-a-brac adorning the walls and hanging from the rafters were a huge wooden fork and spoon, rusted animal traps, leather coats and motorcycle jackets.
Holy hell.
A rusted rake and pitchfork, a riding boot, and crop and a saddle. Every available space was filled with old newspapers, clothes, and books, and the extensive video collection dealt predominantly with horror and death.
Wow.
She was basically living in the weirdest shenanigans I've ever heard of.
I feel like the creepiest lodge up in the creepiest mountains wouldn't even look this bad.
No. No. Bad. But she loved it.
That was
her jam. Yeah. She couldn't wait to decorate this house she'd bought.
That's nuts.
Can you imagine somebody decorating a wall with a motorcycle jacket and a boot?
I like how you went directly to the motorcycle jacket, not the other weird things, but
you know,
that.
Like the taxidermy animals and the skulls and stuff like that.
Like traps and stuff.
Yeah, rusty old animal traps.
And my motorcycle jacket.
Oh, my God. She was obsessed with death.
Yes.
After an argument where she hit Saunders in the face with an iron, he had iron marks on his face.
So was it on? Was the iron on?
Yeah.
Okay.
left a mark before stabbing him in the stomach with a pair of scissors.
Shit.
He decided to move back to Scone.
No kidding.
But when he later returned home, to her home, she had cut up all of his clothes. So, and actually it's more that she had cut up all of his clothes. He was very sentimental about his father. His father had died.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the clothes that he had belonged to his dad.
Oh, no.
And she destroyed something that was very sentimental to him. And he said, no fucking way. I'm not staying here. You suck.
But you do have a child.
Of all the things that could happen.
With her.
She literally hit you in the face with a hot iron. But cutting up your dad's clothes was too far.
That was the breaking point.
Okay.
Whatever, but.
Yeah. So Saunders took a long service leave from work and went into hiding after
but
that.
Without his child, again.
Yes.
I don't understand.
Well, I think that throughout this, the men are not worried about the kids.
Which is bananas.
Maybe because of the way she treated the kids. I don't know.
Okay.
She never did anything to her kids. So I don't know.
I don't
know. Her anger was directed towards men and men only.
Yeah.
And at this point, she only has girls, so.
Still, it's not a good environment.
It's not.
At all.
No, it's terrible. Kathy tried to find him, but no one admitted to knowing where he was, which is smart.
They're like, it would be better not to
tell anybody. Several months later, he returned to see his daughter and found that Kathy had gone to the police and told them she was afraid of him.
Of course.
And they issued her with an apprehended violence order, an AVO, against him.
Again, it's very difficult for people to wrap their heads around women as the aggressor.
Yeah. No matter how aggressive she was.
Yes.
We're going to go into her third serious relationship. John Chillingworth. In 1990... Kathy became pregnant again by a 43-year-old former Avatar co-worker, John Chillingworth.
So fourth child, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And gave birth the following year to a boy named Eric. Mm. Their relationship lasted 3 years before she left him for a man she had been having an affair with for some time, John Price.
So a couple of Davids, a couple of Johns.
Yes. So John, he was also called Pricey. Price.
Oh, that's cute.
Pricey was like his nickname. Was the father of three children when him and Kathy had an affair. He was reputably a terrific bloke, in quotes, mm-hmm. liked by everyone who knew him. But his own marriage had ended in 1988.
So she was the one having an affair?
Yes.
Okay. He was not married?
Correct.
Okay.
While his two-year-old daughter had remained with his former wife, the two older children lived with him. So Price was well aware of Kathy's violent reputation when she moved into his house in 1995. His children liked her.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, she was always probably good to the kids.
Okay.
He was making a lot of money working in the local mines, and apart from violent arguments at first, in quotes, life was a bunch of roses.
Wow.
So in the book, there's a lot of information about who Pricey was and what people thought of him.
Yeah.
Like, I know they always say about people who are murder victims that they, you know, were the light of someone's life and they lit up a room and all that stuff. This guy was really well loved.
So he really did light up a room.
He had a lot of friends. He was beloved. His kids loved him.
Wow.
He was special to a lot of people.
And so crazy that someone like that would have fallen. Yeah, for her.
I don't know what that is. Well, see, that's the hard part about Kathy is that, yes, she's violent and crazy, but she's also, like.
Does it always move that fast?
No, I just had it zoomed in.
Oh.
So she's violent and crazy sometimes.
Yeah.
But then the times when she's not, things are really good. She's a good mom. She's a good wife. Mm. She wants to have sex a bunch. Like, She's really like a sexual person,
which is exciting. So the exciting parts right. are really, really good.
Which is,
but then when it goes bad, it goes extra, extra bad.
I think why men fall in love with crazy bitches.
No, that's exactly you're right.
Like, why are you, like looking at a couple like why are you married to this person?
It's because she's exciting and exactly. that those parts are fun.
Yeah, I mean. Boo-hoo for us boring people. I like to keep things at a, like a solid just out of five all the time.
Yeah, I'm pretty boring too. Yeah,
nothing's violent. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to get violent. I'm just pretty much going to just walk away and no. be like, whatever, dude.
And like at a certain point, it's like, is the violence what's sexy to you?
Yes, I think sometimes.
Yeah, like it's sexual sadism.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think she definitely had that
right
issue. So in 1998, they had a fight over Price's refusal to marry her. And in retaliation, because of course she has to retaliate, she can't just let something fucking be. Knight videotaped items he had stolen from work and sent the tape to his boss.
He stole things?
So the things that he stole, I'm going to say air quotes, were expired medical kits.
Oh, so probably they stuff were throwing that was, like, not a big
trash.
Deal.
They were throwing them oh. in the trash, and so he took them. So she videotaped the things he had, quote, stolen.
Which he didn't really steal.
Sent the tape to his boss.
If they're in the fucking trash.
And then he got fired. He had worked there for 17 years.
And his, okay, his kids are adults at this point?
No.
Oh.
His kids are still little.
Oh.
So that same day, he was so pissed that he kicked her out. And she went back to her own house while news of what she had done spread through the town.
She's a terrible person.
Yeah. A few months later, Pricey restarted the relationship.
No, Pricey, no. Yeah.
Although he now refused to allow her to move in with him. So, like, you know, we can resume this relationship, but you can't move in with me.
Why would you resume a relationship with someone who did that to you?
I don't know. Because the good times were really good.
Good times were rolling, I guess.
Yeah. But then after that, the fighting became even more frequent, and most of his friends would no longer have anything to do with him while they remained together.
Well, yeah, because it was by proxy at that yeah. point. Like, it's we can't even be around you because she's nuts.
Yeah. So that was 1998. By the year 2000, she was living in the house with John and the children.
So she finagled her way in.
Yes.
Okay.
In February 2000, John endured a series of assaults which escalated to Kathy stabbing him in the chest.
Jesus.
The wound wasn't life-threatening, but it did scare John to the point of getting a restraining order against her, an AVO as they call it, in an attempt to keep her away from him and the children. As if he had a flash of ominous foresight, he told his coworkers that day, if he didn't show up to work the following day, it was because Kathy had killed him.
Mm-mm.
His coworkers tried to convince him to not go home, but John was afraid she would hurt their kids
yeah.
if he didn't go home. So while he was at work, Kathy was out buying new black lingerie and had also videotaped all of her children while making comments, which has since been interpreted as a crude will. I don't know exactly what's on that tape.
Oh, like, so she videotaped stuff and then with their kids there and said, like, so-and-so could get this and so-and-so could get that.
Yeah.
Not like she was going to kill her kids, though, but nobody more like she was going to kill herself.
She's going to kill herself. And nobody wants your fucking animal traps, Kathy.
Nobody.
You fucking weirdo.
Nobody. Oh. Nobody wants that shit.
So, and at one point in the book, she talks to, I can't remember exactly who she talked to. But she said something like, well, if I kill him, I have to kill myself. Like, she had mentioned murder-suicide before.
Oh.
Like, an ideation of it to someone.
Which I feel like she's just been leading up to her right. entire life. Exactly. Somehow.
Which I kind of think she knew.
Yeah.
When John arrived home, no one was there. The kids had been sent away for a sleepover at a friend's house, and Kathy was gone. So John went over to the neighbor's house. And hung out until about 11 p.m. He was friendly with the neighbors. He returned home and went to sleep. Kathy arrived at the house after he was asleep and woke him up to have sex with him. Allegedly, the sex was good. It was fine. She wasn't angry. She didn't strangle him because it was bad. It's theorized that the next moves she made may have been motivated by sexual sadism and narcissism. Okay, this is, it starts to get bad. So buckle up.
Dive in.
Police officers made the following report after arriving at the house the following day. About 6 a.m. on Wednesday, March 1st, a neighbor noticed the victim, John Price, work utility truck was still at his home. So they noticed, like, right away. 6 a.m. is early to be noticing that somebody hasn't left the house yet.
Well, and if he was, like, a utility worker, they usually leave very early.
Yeah. This appeared unusual as the victim normally had left work for each day prior to this time. The neighbor became concerned, as did the employer of the victim, who was by this time making inquiries as to why the victim had not attended work. Attempts were made by the neighbor and another friend to wake the victim by knocking on his bedroom window. The neighbor and friend went to the front door where they saw a small amount of blood on the wood exterior.
Oh no.
Police were contacted and attended about 8 a.m. The police at the scene forced entry to the house through the rear door. Oh, that's so hard to say. Upon entry, the police located the victim's exterior layers of skin.
What?
Hanging from a hook in a doorway arch in the lounge room.
Okay.
I'll get into it.
I'll get
way too into it.
Okay.
They then located the victim's decapitated remains on the lounge floor near a small foyer leading to the front door. A further search of the house by police resulted in them locating Catherine Knight, who was snoring loudly in a comatose condition on a double bed at the end of the house. She was removed from the house immediately by police and later conveyed to hospital by ambulance. So there was also, as the crime scene investigators are going through the house, also this is very, very detailed in the book. There's like blister packs of medication that are all popped and on the table.
Okay.
So she essentially tried to take a bunch of pills and kill herself.
Okay.
But she didn't. She must have fucking failed. Taken the wrong pills because she didn't die. But she did go to the hospital, and that's probably, they pumped her stomach. I don't know what they did. So when the crime scene investigators entered the home, instead of being met with the stench of death, which they often were and were used to, they were welcomed with a pleasant smell of a home-cooked meal.
No. Mm-mm.
Which they would later find out was just sick irony.
Mm-mm.
So in quotes, this is from the book, the victim was lying on an angle with his legs from the knees down, jutting out into the entry foyer under a bricked archway. The top of his headless body was at the foot of a functional gray armchair, which had bloody handprints on the arms and back. An open pack of Winfield blue cigarettes was on the seat cushion next to a sharpening steel, the kind you would see hanging from a butcher's apron. So to sharpen a knife.
Yeah.
John Price had been carefully posed, as if in any other circumstance he were lying on his back ready to watch sports. So it'd be his legs out in front of him, butt on the floor, leaned up against the chair. His legs were crossed, his left ankle over his right. It was symbolic, an act of defilement and contempt. The rest of his left arm was draped casually over an empty plastic bottle of soft drink, Shelley's Club Lemon Squash, which I've never heard of.
Must be Australian.
Yeah. The lid of the plastic bottle was screwed on. A cigarette butt had been dropped carelessly on the carpet on John Price's right side. By now, more than 12 hours post-mortem, parts of his torso had started to yellow as the air affected it, and the crimson of the exposed muscle started to darken. A few inches away was a blood-stained knife, 13.1 centimeters long from its yellow plastic handle to its sharp steel tip. The blade was 17 and a half centimeters long. A later examination would reveal that some of the blade edge had been broken off. So, there were signs of struggle throughout the house. John Price, after being stabbed in his sleep, I will say all of this evidence is corroborated by blood spray analysis. Not by anybody's testimony.
Okay.
Just letting you know. So they sort of follow the blood spatter.
Well, who would testify? There's no one there except Cassie her ass. Was there. We don't believe anything that bitch says.
Right. Well, she doesn't say much.
Nothing.
John Price, after being stabbed in his sleep, so he was asleep after having sex with his girlfriend.
Thought everything was fine. Went to sleep like a normal person.
Didn't have an argument. Nothing happened. He was stabbed. He got up after he was stabbed and made his way down the hallway where Kathy continued to attack him from behind. There was blood spatter about shoulder height all the way down the hallway. He made it to the front door but didn't make it outside. So there's blood on the light switch, like he was trying to turn on the light in the hallway. Yeah. And there's also blood spatter on the doorknob, like he was trying to leave. So he didn't make it outside, and he probably wouldn't have survived the attack at that point anyway, as he had already been stabbed a total of 37 times. And he was bleeding profusely.
37 times?
Yes. He was probably absolutely terrified as he tried to make his way out of the house and away from Kathy, who continued to stab him. He collapsed there at the door in the foyer area and bled out in a large pool of blood.
Oh, Pricey. That's terrible.
So once he was dead, Kathy had her implements of destruction ready. This included a stainless steel meat hook, two smaller knives, the long knife she used to kill him, a sharpening steel, and a Norton sharpening block. She grabbed on John's right arm and dragged him about a meter from the front foyer through the pool of his own blood onto the carpet in the living room. She laid his head on the carpet near the foot of the armchair. Kathy lit a cigarette, removed John's watch, and smashed it down on a framed photograph of his son, breaking the glass.
What?
She also broke a framed photo of his daughter.
Okay, so she got issues with his kids.
Apparently.
Jealousy.
I guess. But it gets weirder. So, this is pretty graphic. So, if you want to skip forward, I don't blame you. Once Pricey was dead, Kathy pushed a knife into his corpse just under the collarbone. It would have met with slight resistance from the skin, but with a sharp blade, Kathy was able to slice horizontally across the top of his body from shoulder to shoulder, right under the clavicles. It was a straight, clean cut, anatomically precise. She then turned and cut the knife down his chest, over his stomach, around his genital area, down the front of his thighs, his knees, and to his feet. She cut down the back of each arm and across the top of his head. With all the incisions complete, she peeled John's skin from his body.
She's a fucking butcher!
Including his scalp, ears, and face.
Yes, she would know exactly how to do that.
This was common practice in the abattoir. She had witnessed and performed this same practice on animals many times.
Yep.
What we would consider inconceivable, she did with confidence and practice, which probably took her back to her work in the boning room she left 15 years prior. It took her about an hour to remove his skin and another 40 minutes or so to cut off his head.
Not even that long.
She did it skillfully, not with an axe or a saw. She slowly and methodically sliced through the tendons, articulated around the bones and cartilage in his neck, as it would have been done in the abattoir. She retrieved her meat hook and pushed one pointed side through his scalp and his curly brown hair and hoisted the skin up and hooked it to the archway divide. His feet touched the floor. Which, I don't know why that makes it more gross.
To what end, Catherine? What end?
Investigators called it the human pelt in their
okay.
reports.
Yeah, the word pelt is disgusting.
Yeah, it weighed about 70 kilograms, which is about 155 pounds. She hoisted it up there by herself. So, once Pricey's skin was removed and his head was removed, she took his head and put it into a big pot on the stovetop.
No, she didn't.
She added water and vegetables and boiled it.
Oh, God.
She sliced off pieces from his buttocks and cooked them like steak. We're about to get to the pumpkin.
Oh, the pumpkin. Now you're just fucked up my cocktail.
Fucked up the cocktail. She peeled. This is like the amount of time she took. She peeled and chopped vegetables to cook like an actual meal.
I'm just really glad we didn't call the cocktail the pumpkin pelt or something like that.
No, oh God.
That would be terrible.
So she peeled and chopped vegetables and prepared them. She baked them in the oven.
So she was just taking her time.
Yeah. Yeah. She set the table for two. One place setting for each of John's children.
Okay.
She had left little place markers for them.
Yeah. Oh, she got major issues there.
Yeah. She served up the meat with baked potato, pumpkin, beetroot, zucchini, cabbage, yellow squash, and gravy at the dinner table, along with notes beside each plate, each one having the name of Price's children on it. Oh. Investigators found a third meal, which was thrown on the back lawn for unknown reasons, and it speculated that Kathy had attempted to eat it but could not.
Oh my God, his poor children.
Horrible. At some point after his death, Kathy went into Aberdeen and withdrew $1,000 from John's checking account. I don't know. That goes nowhere.
That goes nowhere because she's going to kill herself. So what's the purpose of that? Right.
So maybe she got the $1,000 to buy the pills to kill herself. No clue. I have no idea. So after all this and through the investigation, she claimed amnesia. Said she didn't remember a thing.
Oh, please.
But at least half of those involved in the prosecution thought that she was lying.
I believe she's lying.
She was thought to have dissociative amnesia, which is a recognized mental disorder, although not all psychologists agree that she had that issue. Dissociative amnesia is not the same as simple amnesia, which involves a loss of information from memory, usually as a result of disease or injury to the brain. With dissociative amnesia, the memories still exist but are deeply buried within the person's mind and cannot be recalled. However, the memories might resurface on their own or after being triggered by something in the person's surroundings. Although amnesia after a murder is pretty common, it's said to happen about 65% of the time, which is interesting. Kathy remembers more than she initially let on. She claimed to only remember the moments leading up to his murder. She was like, oh, yeah, we had sex. He went to the bathroom, peed, and then I fell asleep.
Also, I don't really care if you remember or not. It doesn't negate matter. The fact that you did it. Like, right. So what if you remember? Who cares?
And apparently 65% of the time, they don't.
Well, yeah, because a lot of people do things in, like, the heat of passion. But to me, what she did was not the heat of passion. The heat of passion is, like, when you stab someone and then it's like, oh, shit, or you shoot someone. Not that you take an hour and 40 fucking minutes to depelt them.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? There's no way. She's full of shit.
I agree. She's full of shit. So, but according to the judge who presided over her trial, Kathy enjoyed the killing.
Yes, I believe.
Judge Justice O'Keefe, who was the one who presided over her trial, said, the last minutes of his, John Price's, life must have been a time of abject terror for him, as they were a time of utter enjoyment for her. She has not expressed any contrition or remorse, and if released, she poses a serious threat to the security of society. Agreed. At her trial in October 2001, Catherine Knight saved John Price's distraught family the ordeal of having to hear all the evidence by pleading guilty. According to court-appointed psychiatrist, she was perfectly sane when she committed the crimes. Which is a good thing that his family didn't have to sit through that. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that she pled guilty. Because she's fucking guilty.
That's wild.
On November 8th, Justice Barry O'Keefe sentenced Catherine Mary Knight to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. The judge said that her papers were to be marked never to be released. She has since appealed the severity of the sentence. Of course.
They always do.
It is open to debate as to whether or not Kathy ate parts of her boyfriend after she cooked his head and slices from his buttocks. Mm. It was hard to say if all of the pieces of John Price were accounted for. To this day, she maintains that all she recalls of that night is that they had good sex and both climaxed.
Liar.
Then she remembers that Pricey got out of bed to go for a pee, and she watched him come back to the bedroom. After that, she presumes she fell asleep, and that was that. The general consensus of opinion, and in this case everyone seems to have one, is that she ate part of John Price and found what she did was so abhorrent that she chooses to block it out of her mind. In Malawa Women's Correctional Center, Kathy works as a cleaner in the governor's office. Although she is a good cook, it's highly unlikely she will ever get a job in the kitchen. I would hope not. I've also, like, I'll post a picture of her. She just looks like any old lady at this point.
Any old lady.
But I've heard that she's, like, sort of like a motherly figure in prison. Disgusting. And the fact that I know that sentencing is different sometimes for women than it is men, because that's the way it is. Mm-hmm. I feel like life in prison without parole is not enough.
What would you...
If I was her family, I would not be satisfied with that. That should be capital murder.
Yeah, I don't even know if they have the death penalty there, do
they? I think it would... In America, that would be capital murder.
Yeah. There's, we don't even hardly have the death penalty anymore.
But still.
Yeah. No, I agree with what you're saying.
That would not be... I mean, that is...
I mean, his poor children, even having to hear
so
that...
So heinous.
Would be so awful. I can't imagine. And I don't believe for 2 seconds that she forgot. I feel like she thinks of it every day of her fucking life.
Yeah.
Just my own thought.
She probably smiles about it every day.
I just feel like it, yeah.
She's a sick,
yeah,
sick,
I mean, if she
woman.
Was just like a normal human all of those years and then all of a sudden something weird happened, possibly.
No, she was leading up to this.
But she was
the whole
cuckoo
time.
Bananas for years and years and years and years. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no.
And everybody knew it.
Cuckoo. Sad. Kathy. Yeah, no. Mm-mm.
And even though she's a woman, you should always take domestic violence seriously.
I agree. No, it is, people just don't always take it seriously when it's like woman to man, you know?
Especially if her mom says, you better watch out for her, she'll fucking kill you.
Yeah, I mean, and she was right just about the wrong husband, right, or the wrong boyfriend.
Yeah.
Wow, that was a rough one, dude. You got through it, though.
Oh, my God.
That was terrible.
Sorry I made you make a pumpkin drink after that.
No, that's okay. Our pumpkin drink is really good. I think it's, I mean, it's a rough story to tell.
It's not.
It's
Australian,
terrible.
But,
I mean, you know, from what you said, Pricey was a good person, and he should be remembered.
He should be.
You know, it's too bad he has to be remembered that way, but, you know, yeah, it should be remembered what she did. In my opinion.
I agree.
And that's why we do this.
And the book is very good. I got it on Audible. It's there. I think it's like...
It's there.
I think it's like 12 bucks or something, but it really goes into like very good detail about her life and his life and just sort of how things unfolded in such a fucking bizarre way.
Right.
For both of them.
Good job, April.
Thanks. It was a rough one.
Yeah. I feel you.
So, if anybody wants to reach out to us, you can email us at killerspiritspod@gmail.com. We're on Instagram, where we post our drink photos and photos from the show, at killerspiritspod on Instagram. We're also on TikTok, killerspiritspod, and patreon.com/killerspiritspod, which is where we post our drink tutorial videos. I'm like, what the fuck do we post there? And we're also at some point going to be doing a cookbook. You can check us out on Etsy.
Did you have to say cookbook after this
episode? I mean recipe book. I didn't mean cook.
We're not cooking in it. No. You're making cocktails.
That's
literally it.
You can check us out on Etsy if you want any Killer Spirits Pod merch. And I don't know. I think that's all I got.
That's all she's got. She's worn out from
this
one.
I'm exhausted from this today.
And make sure you go rate and review. We love to see your reviews. We'll read them on air for you.
We love that.
We love you guys. Thank you so much.